Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for October's Small Animal Practice Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce our speaker for today, European and RCVS recognised specialist in small animal surgery, Scott Rutherford. Thank you, Scott. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you and welcome to everybody to this webinar, an update on cruciate surgery. In actual fact, we're going to talk about cruciate disease today. We'll talk a little bit about the anatomy, the etiopathogenesis of cruciate disease, and then a little bit about the history, clinical signs and diagnosis. Mainly because there are a lot of misconceptions and you know, incorrect facts floating around out there. And then we'll concentrate on what are the treatment options and what should you ideally do when presented with your case. We'll finally talk a little bit about the meniscus. And then as a quick last point, just a couple of words on the caudal cruciate. So the cruciate ligaments are intra-articular, okay, so they're actually, as we know, within the joint, but strictly speaking, they're extra-synovial because they're covered by synovium. And we, as everybody knows, we term them cranial and caudal based on their tibial attachment. And as cranial cruciate ligament disease is so common, that's the one that we'll concentrate on. The cranial cruciate ligaments divided into two bands, with the caudal lateral, which is the larger band, and then the cranial medial. And to know that is actually quite important because they differ in their function. So the caudal lateral band is taut in stifle extension, whereas the cranial medial is taut in flexion and extension. Okay. So the cranial medial stabilizes the knee in all ranges of motion. So if you had a partial tear and it was only the caudal lateral band that was torn, there could be no cranial draw because the cranial medial stabilizes in flexion and extension. So often, I'll read in histories, etc., that can't be cruciate ligament disease as no cranial draw, okay, which is factually incorrect. So you could have absolutely no instability in the knee because only the caudal lateral band is torn. If only the cranial medial band is torn, then you'd have cranial draw in stifle flexion because the caudal lateral stabilizes in extension. Okay, so the key points to take away about the anatomy of the cruciate ligaments are you have to test for cranial draw in flexion and extension, and if you elicit no cranial draw, that does not exclude cranial cruciate ligament disease. So, cranial cruciate ligament disease is the most common cause of pelvic limb lameness in the dog. That was found in a BVOA survey that was published in VCOT in the mid-90s, but it's still the case today. And notice I use the word disease. This is to differentiate it from a traumatic rupture of the cranial cruciate ligament. Now that, in actual fact, is an extremely rare injury in dogs. That's what we would normally see in humans. So where that you have a completely normal ligament and there's a very abnormal force placed on the knee and the ligament ruptures. Okay, and as I say, that is often talked about in dogs based on the history that there is an acute lameness, but in actual fact, a true traumatic rupture is exceedingly rare. Normally, what happens is it's a progressive degeneration of the cranial cruciate ligament. And what happens over time, you get loss of the cells within the ligament. It weakens and it can tear. And it can finally acutely go. So it might be that as a dog is running, it suddenly goes lame, and non-weight bearing lame, and the owners haven't noticed too much of a problem before. But it's still actually very rare that that's a traumatic rupture. In most cases, if you carefully question the owner, there has been some previous problems. And then when you look at it on radiographs, there's evidence of osteoarthritis telling you that it's been there for a longer period of time than the owner has suggested by the history. There are a few occasions when you can get a true traumatic rupture of the cruciate ligament. On this image, you see a dog jumping up to catch a frisbee. It's actually on a beach. That is one way that they can traumatically rupture it. So if they were to jump up and land awkwardly with their foot planted solidly on the ground, and often in sand, for example, and the knee twists, they could actually truly traumatically rupture the cruciate ligament. The other one is with serious trauma. If they get their leg caught in a gate or a fence that they've jumped, or sometimes in a road traffic accident. But often in those circumstances, it isn't an isolated cranial cruciate ligament rupture. They also have, caudal cruciate rupture or collateral ligament rupture. So the thing to take is that in at least 99% of the case, it's this progressive degeneration of the cruciate ligament. And our knowledge, we've known that has happened for 90 odd years. It was first described in 1926, and despite a huge amount of research, especially since the 1950s, the cause and the pathogenesis of this is still unknown. We don't really understand what's going on. We do know that there's loss in metaplasia of the ligamentocytes, and that there is a loss of collagen fibers within the cruciate itself. But why this happens is still unknown. There's many factors being implicated, lots of studies, and the factors are implicated in some studies and then refuted in others. But abnormal conformation in gait can play a role. There's discussion about the increased tibial plateau angle, although that's quite tricky because they've looked at sighthounds, particularly greyhounds, that have known to have a very low incidence of cruciate ligament disease, and they can have the same or steeper tibial plateau angle than dogs, a population of dogs that are affected by the disease. So again, that's unknown. Obesity's been implicated. And it would certainly seem that we would see more cases in obese dogs, which makes sense, if the ligament is going to progressively degenerate and there's increased forces acting on that knee, through obesity. It would make sense that the progression would be greater. Lack of fitness has been implicated, and actually there's some recent work being done at the University of Liverpool that will hopefully be published, that shows that if you have a fitter, more active dog, they are more likely to be free of cranial cruciate ligament disease. So it's your unfit dogs that are more likely to get it, and that would certainly fit in with the clinical population that I see. Most of the dogs that we see for cruciate ligament disease are overweight, and not particularly active, fit dogs. Breed variation, plays a role. As I said before, sighthounds, it's very rare to get cranial cruciate ligament disease. Not impossible, but very rare. Other dogs is hugely prevalent in, but if you think about it, we'll see a huge number of Labradors, Golden Retrievers, Boxers, Newfoundlands, Border Terriers, West Highland White Terriers. So there are a number of breeds that we will see it more frequently in. It's shown to be more prevalent in neutered animals than unneutered animals, although some of these studies are slightly biased because of the sheer degree of neutering, there could be statistical errors in that, and we see more females than males. Everybody talks about a sort of typical history of cranial cruciate ligament disease, and I would say that there actually isn't a typical history. It's highly variable. You can have from extremely subtle lamenesses up to non-weight-bearing lamenesses. The lameness can be worse after exercise. It could be worse after periods of rest. People might only see stiffness. So as I say, I don't read too much into the history because there's very little that would make me think, oh, must be cruciate or must not be cruciate. It's very important to note, though, that for us, it's very easy to diagnose a complete rupture. When they're non-weight bearing, the stifle's very swollen, very painful. But if you have a fairly stable partial tear, the clinical signs could be very mild, and often only noticed after strenuous exercise. So don't be drawn into the fact that they must have severe clinical signs to have cranial cruciate ligament disease. Yes, if a complete rupture, they probably do. As I say, with these stable partial tears that are very common, it can be extremely difficult to diagnose them. There's a number of tests on physical exam that can really help us come to a diagnosis or a provisional diagnosis. Stifle pain. A test that I rely on a lot is hyperextending the stifle. If you hyperextend the stifle in a normal dog, they should normally tolerate that really quite well. However, if there is a partial tear, you're putting increased load on the cruciate ligament, and it will be have a pain response. So that's something that I use a lot. You'll also see stifle pain just in general flexion and extension of the joint. Flexion may well be associated with a meniscal injury. Crepitus within the joint is often quite common, especially in these more chronic cases. Again, it's not specific or pathognomonic to cranial cruciate ligament disease, but it does help you narrow it down to the stifle. Again, something that I very rarely see in the histories and that is a good indicator of a problem is muscle atrophy. I would implore everybody during their examination of normal dogs and lame dogs to check muscles. It's just a very good indicator that you have a significant problem in that limb from disuse atrophy. And with cruciate disease, we'll often see quadriceps muscle atrophy. This is one of the most important things because the quadriceps are very important in the recovery of the disease. So if you have significant quadriceps atrophy, it's likely to prolong the rehabilitation. So it's something that should be checked for every single time. Periarticular soft tissue fibrosis and thickening is very common with this problem and the more chronic problems, and everybody will be aware of the medial buttress that you can feel. One of the most significant tests, and it was actually shown in a paper a number of years ago to be the most reliable, is loss of the distinct band of the patellar ligament. So if you feel a normal dog's patellar ligament, you should have really quite nice, distinct edges, quite sharp edges. And if you lose that, it suggests that there's synovitis or an effusion, which doesn't have to be caused by cranial cruciate ligament disease, but it's by far the most likely cause of an effusion or synovitis within the stifle joint. So that is a test I rely on a lot. And again, I would just say to people, go around and feel lots of normal dogs' patellar ligaments to get an idea of what we mean by that sharp, distinct band. Another good test that you can look at the dog is in your consulting room or in the waiting room is they often sit with the affected leg projecting out. They don't want to sit with it highly flexed because that can be painful. So they'll sit over to the other side with the affected leg sort of in an extended position. And again, it doesn't mean it is cranial cruciate ligament disease, but it's a very useful test to give you an idea. Few things to remember when you're doing your physical exam is that cranial cruciate ligament disease affects both stifles in up to 40 to 50% of cases. Now that doesn't mean at the same time. So one stifle could be completely normal, but it's extremely important that you examine both stifles, okay? And if both stifles are actually affected, it can be really difficult to spot a mild bilateral lameness. If you're not looking closely or you're not used to looking at lameness, these dogs can appear normal. So often what you're looking for is some circumduction of limbs where they swing them out, or a shortened stride and a shorter sort of stance phase. But that takes quite a lot of experience to get good at. And if you have a mild bilateral lameness and you've got very mild clinical signs like very minimal periarticular fibrosis, not really got much of an effusion or anything like this, a stoic dog with minimal pain, you can interpret some of these signs that the dog is actually normal when it's not. So it can be very difficult to diagnose partial tears. And you've got to have a high index of suspicion for these. So the dog might not look lame, might have no cranial drawer, but if you pick up subtle periarticular fibrosis, subtle effusions in the joint, pain and hyperextension, then you've got this high index of suspicion for a partial tear. At the other end of the spectrum, some dogs can be so severely bilaterally affected with bilateral ruptures that they actually can't walk and they present non-ambulatory. These cases will often be mistaken as a spinal case. Okay, so somebody will think they've got thoracolumbar intervertebral disc disease and they're actually paraparetic or paraplegic. Okay, when actually it's their stifles. And a big indicator of that is that they can still move their legs. They have normal voluntary motion. They are attempting to move their legs all the time. They just find it difficult to bear their weight. And if they don't look as if there's weakness or neurological deficits on the back legs, go straight to the stifles and have a feel for them. Because if they are non-ambulatory, it should be a very easy diagnosis to make because almost certainly they are at a complete rupture or near complete rupture. So say there are a number of these diagnostic tests that are really useful. As we said, palpation of the patellar ligament, that's been very well correlated to cranial cruciate ligament disease. So do get used to feeling for these distinct sharp bands along the patellar ligament. Pain and hyperextension, that's one of my go-to tests, sort of straight away for partial tears, because if you hyperextend the stifle and it's painful, they're most likely to have a partial cranial cruciate ligament disease. We've got the tests that everybody knows: cranial drawer test and the tibial compression test. Okay. The cranial drawer test is indicated in the photograph at the top. And this is where we would take the forefinger of one hand and place that on the patella. The thumb of that hand would be placed on the lateral fibula. Then on the other hand, we'd have the thumb on the head of the fibula and your finger on the tibial tuberosity. Okay. And we're feeling for cranial caudal instability in the knee. Now there's a number of sort of nuances to that test, so they can be misinterpreted. Okay, you need to hold on to these bony protuberances, and you need to hold on tight. So when you're thinking, your fingers should be blanched because you're really holding on tight, and it's important to go cranial and caudal, don't make a torsional change because that could be misinterpreted as instability in the knee. So it's cranial and caudal with your hands, and the test must be performed rapidly. Okay, if you perform it slowly, you will pick up, you know, where there is significant cranial drawer, i.e. a complete rupture, but you'll miss subtle cranial drawer and it will be appreciated as normal. So it's really important to do that test quickly. And as I say, if you hold only skin, you could get the skin to move and be interpreted as normal. As there's instability when there's not. And if you don't do it rapidly, subtle instability could appear normal. The tibial compression test is a little bit different in the bottom photograph. So what you would do is you would have the palm of one hand on the distal aspect, distal cranial aspect of the femur, and you'd run your forefinger along from the patella down to the tibial tuberosity. Then we would have our other hand on the paw, and we would flex and extend the hock as you hold the stifle stable. And what you're looking for on the hand, the finger that's on the tibial tuberosity, you should feel that move forward. So you're feeling for cranial tibial subluxation. And again, these are tests that can be misinterpreted. So I always perform these tests in the conscious animal. If I feel no instability, so the cranial drawer and the tibial compression test are negative, I don't take that as gospel. Because when you anaesthetise the animal and you give them some pain relief and their muscles relax, you could feel instability. So these tests should be performed in the conscious animal, but you should also repeat them when the animal is sedated or anaesthetised to confirm what you found. We've based our diagnosis on our history and our clinical exam. Okay, so either we've made a diagnosis of cranial cruciate ligament rupture because we've felt in the cranial caudal instability, or we've got a high index of suspicion. So we then move to radiographs. And these are necessary in all cases, even if you know that you've got a cranial cruciate ligament rupture. Okay, you need to verify osteoarthritis, the severity of it, and therefore how long this has been going on, and this will help give a prognosis to the owners. You need to rule out fractures and neoplasia. Every now and again, you'll get caught out. There's a painful stifle, it's cranial cruciate ligament disease, but actually it's got a distal femoral osteosarc. Okay. And then in your challenging cases where you aren't totally sure of the diagnosis, it will confirm that you've got stifle pathology. Okay. And as a plea, I must ask everybody to take orthogonal views. I see a lot of radiographs are sent to me for critique and complications, etc., of different procedures, and I often are given single views, and you cannot completely evaluate a radiograph unless you take orthogonal views. So please, as a plea, always, always, always take them and try to get them as perfect as you possibly can. So when you look at our radiographs, there's a few things that we're looking for. Okay, we're looking at the so-called effacement of the infrapatellar fat pad. So if you look behind the straight patellar ligament, as you can see with the arrow, you've got this sort of darker black grey area, and then you've got the whitey grey. Okay, so the fat pad in a normal dog would come over to the cranial aspect of the tibial plateau. So when this is reduced in size and it's squashed by this soft tissue density within the stifle, that's suggestive of an effusion or synovitis, synovial hyperplasia. Okay. The other one we look for is caudal distension of the synovium out caudally that we can see here. Okay. Well, that can sometimes be difficult to see. Then we're also looking for osteo and physophyte formation. So on the tibial condyle, particularly the insertion of the cranial cruciate ligament, we will see in physophytes there. We look for this so-called watermark of watermark of osteophytes down the femoral trochlear ridge and on the distal pole of the patella. We'll also sometimes see on the condyle, you can see this sort of pagoda sign of osteophytes. Another one we look for is subchondrosclerosis, which can be very subtle, but especially of the tibial condyle, we'll see some of this subchondrosclerosis. There's a whole bunch of other possible tests you can do to diagnose it. So you can, in humans, for example, the gold standard for diagnosing cranial cruciate ligament disease is, or cranial cruciate ligament rupture, is an MRI. You can use CT arthrograms. We can use stifle arthroscopy and look within the joint and have a look at it. If you're extremely good with an ultrasound machine, you can certainly see the menisci on those and diagnose tests. Now, I very seldom perform any of these tests to diagnose cranial cruciate ligament disease. I've never used an MRI or CT arthrograms or ultrasound. In a very occasional case, my index of suspicion has been very high and I've maybe used arthroscopy or a mini arthrotomy to confirm this. But, you know, we're talking about a handful of cases and I would be unlikely to do that now. So if I know I've got a chronic lameness, I've got pain in the stifle, a number of the tests that we talked about that are highly suggestive of cruciate disease, and then radiographic findings of an effusion synovitis and osteoarthritis, I'm happy that that's cranial cruciate ligament disease, as long as there's no sign of any other problem. So most of the time, these expensive other tests aren't necessary. And in actual fact, they just eat into the money you have to treat the disease. So it's very unlikely I would use any of these. So now, in the second half, we'll talk about our treatment options, okay? And essentially, our treatment options for cranial cruciate ligament disease come down to conservative management, traditional surgery, or the osteotomy procedures, all right? So traditional surgery, if you like, what we're talking about there, is we are looking to replace or mimic the cranial cruciate ligament. So the idea of those is to passively stabilise the joint. So we're aiming to eliminate cranial draw. We don't want any of the cranial caudal instability of the stifle after those surgeries. Now, sort of more recent procedures, the osteotomy procedures, these are biomechanical modifications. So, and with these, they talk about dynamically stabilizing the joint, okay? But stabilizing the joint with regards to these procedures isn't a particularly good term. The idea of these is not to eliminate cranial draw, okay? So we are not replacing or mimicking the action of the cruciate ligament. So these dogs will almost always have a degree of cranial draw afterwards. So if you pick the leg up into space, it's unstable. However, if you were the dog was to walk or run on it, the idea is that it's stable. All right. So that's a very important fact to know the difference between the traditional surgical techniques and the tibial osteotomies. OK. Okay. And it will often be talked about that after a tibial osteotomy, people say, oh, there's still cranial drawer. Okay, there always will be in the vast majority of cases because we haven't aimed to passively stabilize the joint. Okay, the idea is that as the dog walks and weight bears, the muscles retrain and actually stabilize the joint. So if we look at conservative treatment first, conservative treatment can be used in almost all cases. Now, in general, it's accepted that surgery should give a more favorable and more predictable outcome than conservative management. And that's the opinion of the vast majority of orthopedic surgeons. However, there's very little evidence to back that up at the moment. And there are a number of people that will say they get good results from conservative treatment. The problem is that it's actually very difficult to do a true non-surgical rehabilitation program in animals. In humans, there has been a move away from surgery in a large proportion of cases, especially less athletic, less active people. And that will be, if you're a cynic, perhaps due to finances, but they can get good results. But in humans, they are told exactly what to do, exactly what exercises to do, how often to do it. So we get suboptimal results in dogs normally, but it's certainly worth trying. Now, really, the conservative treatment comes down to two things: the controlled exercise regime, physiotherapy, and then non-steroidal painkillers. Okay. Now, what I see all the time is that people recommend rest for cranial cruciate ligament disease. Okay, rest is contraindicated. The ligament is going to degenerate regardless of what you do. Okay, it will not degenerate further because of exercise, and the benefits of exercise far outweigh the risks. So you need to improve the muscles. You need to build muscle bulk. You need to retrain those muscles and improve the proprioception. And what you're aiming for is periarticular fibrosis, which will in the end stabilize the joint. Physiotherapy becomes a very important part of the conservative management. And I just get a little bit my high horse here. I've got a big bugbear. Veterinary physiotherapy is not a protected title. So lots of people can do little courses, diploma courses, certificates in physiotherapy and call themselves a veterinary physiotherapist and contend that they are not physiotherapists. So if you're going to embark on a physiotherapy regime with dogs, it's really important that we use human-trained physios that have had a proper degree in physiotherapy and then they've dual-trained into animals. So I'd always recommend an ACPAT physio. And the results they can get can be very good. As I say, the problem with this is that in humans, we would be told to do a number of exercises a number of times a day, which really can't happen in dogs. So unless they're going for physiotherapy two, three times a week, you're not going to get as good a result. As I say, with the non-steroidals, I would always use prolonged courses, 6, 8, 10, 12 weeks, okay, to really build up the exercise, get them using the leg, get the muscle bulk improved, and the proprioception and the retraining of the neuromuscular system. So conservative treatment is definitely an option, especially early on in the disease, especially in partial tears. You have got very little to lose by recommending a period of 6 to 8 weeks of conservative treatment. However, if at the end of the 6 to 8 weeks you've had minimal treatment, minimal improvement, or you have a recurrence, then that's when surgery is indicated. The other one is with complete ruptures, surgery will give an almost certainly a better result. But that doesn't mean that you cannot treat a full tear non-surgically. You just have to discuss with the owners that the prognosis is likely to be worse. And to me, the only reason to do that would be a financial one. But certainly, if there is no way the owners can have surgery, then conservative treatment could be effective. So there's no reason not to try conservative management in those cases. You have to be, as I said, critical of the success of it, okay, and really do check. And it's no good just to send them home with non-steroidals and a bit of controlled exercise. If you want it to be successful, you really need to push for physiotherapy to retrain those muscles and build everything up. If we then talk about the traditional surgeries, the first thing to take from this is that lots exist, okay? There are literally tens and tens and tens of these described. And the reason for that is that none of them are perfect, okay? If we had a perfect answer, we'd have one surgery for it, okay? But we just don't. The initial traditional surgical techniques were intra-articular prostheses, and these are the Pacsama type techniques. So Pacsama was a Finnish surgeon that first described surgeries in the 1950s. Okay, and very similar to what would be done in humans. Okay, these are technically quite a challenging surgery, so sort of fell out of failure. Favor. We'll talk about intra-articular reconstruction again in a second, okay? But then we have the over-the-top techniques, okay, which were a simplification of the Pat-Sama techniques, and that's one of the surgeries I started out doing, where you take a fascia lata graft, pass it through the joint, and attach it round the back back onto the joint capsule. Fairly aggressive surgery, fairly damaging, and a major problem with that is that we are putting in fascia lata, which has an elastic component to it to treat what is a very inelastic ligament. So there's multiple different types of intra-articular reconstruction. We'll talk about those again, but because they are quite damaging and often had a failure rate, extracapsular techniques were sought. So the idea of the extracapsular techniques are these are less damaging to the joint. So we are not going into the joint to put a prosthesis or a graft, and we're mimicking the action of the cruciate ligament outside the joint. But there is a number of problems with each of those techniques. So if you think about these intra-articular reconstructions, they can use an autograft. So we would use fascia lata grafts. People have even used skin grafts, and I believe there's somebody still doing that at the moment. In humans, they'll take your hamstring graft, or they will take part of your patella ligament and replace that into the joint and anchor it really at the insertion and origin of the cruciate ligament. And over time, that will form. Strengthen and form a false ligament, a so-called neoligament. And there's many other different types. You can use allografts, so from the same species but a different animal. Xenografts, so there's bovine grafts have been used in dogs, and you can even use synthetic grafts. But then you have a problem with potentially in infection and things with these other grafts. So these surgeries, intra-articular reconstructions, are very successful in humans. And so there are a number of attractive elements to this in our patients. However, the major issue that we've got is that it takes about 3 to 6 months for these grafts to heal and strengthen, which means that you can't the dog has to be rested and go through a proper rehabilitation. And often they would fail. So often they will break or loosen before they've actually had a chance to heal, which means you're back to square one. And in actual fact, you're worse than square one because we've already said they damage the joint, but you haven't achieved the stability you set out to achieve. And because our rehabilitation programs are always suboptimal to humans and historically have been actually quite poor, these are always set to fail. So although there are a number of very attractive qualities about them, the fact of the matter is that as they are at the moment, they don't have as a particularly good success rate. Hence why looking for something else. So then if we go on to the extra capsular stabilization, the sort of lateral fibula suture was first described in the early 70s. And the idea is we're using some material that's anchored generally outside the joint that is roughly in the angle of the cruciate ligament. So if we take here, have a sort of original lateral fibula tibial suture, goes in this direction, which is sort of the direction of the cranial cruciate ligament, okay? So we'd hopefully stabilize the knee. Now, there are a number of problems with extracapsular stabilization. There's the materials problem. The cranial cruciate ligament is extremely strong and extremely inelastic. Okay, most of the materials that we use are stretchy, so they are never as good as the cranial cruciate ligament, and they all break eventually. They all loosen or break. So we don't get long-term stability from them. So what we're still hoping for is extra-articular fibrosis, periarticular fibrosis, to stabilize the joint. Another point is that we don't actually stabilize the knee from the origin and insertion of the cruciate ligament. The lateral suture is fixed at points outside the joint. So it doesn't do exactly what the cranial cruciate ligament does. Now, there was a lot of effort gone in to find isometric points where we could start and finish the suture. Now, isometric points are points on the femur and the tibia that are equidistant, so they remain the same distance apart throughout motion, okay, so throughout flexion and extension. And the femur actually has a cam action, so it moves ever so slightly cranial and caudal throughout motion and stance. So these isometric points do not exist, okay? So there is no point that we can anchor our suture that is remains equidistant throughout motion. So at some point throughout flexion and extension, your suture, your material you've put in, loosens and tightens. Okay, so it doesn't do the job of the cruciate ligament. The final one is a stability problem. The aim of a stabilization, a passive stabilization, either intra-articular reconstruction or the extracapsular stabilization, is to passively stabilize the joint. So we're trying to eliminate cranial drawer. Okay, and in actual fact, 100% of these stifles are unstable when they've looked at them with fluoroscopy, the dynamic fluoroscopy. Okay, so you aim to stabilize the joint and you don't achieve it. So there's a number of problems there. Now, that doesn't mean that you can't have some success with the lateral fibrotibial suture. The way that I would always describe it is, if I had a fairly active dog and the owners wanted that dog to be active again, I would say that after the lateral fibrotibial suture, probably about 70% chance of good success, i.e. the dog being as active as it was previously. Whereas if we take the tibial osteotomies, I'd expect it to be 95%. Okay. So the suture is not as good as one of the tibial osteotomies. But then many people can't afford to have a tibial osteotomy. So the suture is a good second choice. And there's a number of key points that will increase the chance of success. So I want to just go through some of those now. And they are that the suture passes round or through the fibrofemoral ligament, the correct positioning of the bone tunnel in the cranial proximal tibia, getting the correct tension on the suture, and a proper rehabilitation program. So we'll go through those in more detail. You need to identify the fibrofemoral ligament, which is actually the tendon of origin of the gastrocnemius. So you can actually feel where the fibula is, and then you can get around the ligament. Okay, so the suture that you pass must go behind the fibrous tissue, okay, or just through it. However, you don't want to entrap too much soft tissue, because if you trap a lot of the muscle around it, it will actually just over time cheese wire through that, and you will lose some of the tension on your suture. Okay. So the key point to placing the suture is identify the lateral fibula, okay? Retract the biceps femoris, as can be seen in the photograph at the top. Get the suture behind the fibrous tissue, the fibula, okay, without entrapping too much soft tissue. And if it's properly placed, when you have it there and you pull on both ends of the suture, you should lift the dog off the table. Okay, it should feel extremely secure in that position. The tibial drill hole must be in the proximal cranial tibia, okay, and it's as proximal and cranial as possible. So in this radiograph, we'd have put the red dot is where the hole should be. Okay, now most people put it too distal and too caudal, all right, and then you're actually not mimicking the as well the action of the cruciate ligament. So you must get that drill hole in the correct position. Then we've got to get the correct tension on the suture. Okay, it's the technical error is if there is too much tension, okay, and too little. If it's too little, we haven't eliminated the cranial draw and it's unstable. If you have too much tension, it will just break straight away, okay, and you'll have achieved nothing. Okay. So to test your tension, you want to be able to tension the device, the suture, okay, which you can do by gently crimping your clamp in the middle, getting an assistant to hold, or using the tensioning device, as in the photo at the bottom, and then test the knee, okay? So you want to eliminate cranial draw, but maintain a full range of motion, but prevent outward rotation of the femur, okay? The tensioning, the suture, at the end, pulls that clamp flat to the tissue, okay? So it can be quite difficult to crimp it, as you see in the picture at the bottom. So the secret there is to lift one suture, okay, to tip the crimp, and then squeeze the crimp hard in three places, the middle and at both ends. Remember, you must be at least a millimetre away from each end, okay? Otherwise, you could actually snap the suture with the ends of the crimp, and then cut off the sutures close to the crimp. And the crimp should actually sit at the cranial tibialis muscle, okay? So it should be quite distal. Rehabilitation of these patients is really important, okay? So they have really 1 week pretty strict rest, but then 8 weeks of gradually increasing exercise. Okay, so you'd start off 5, 10 minutes, and just slowly build up their exercise. Each week they get slightly longer on the lead. Okay, and then when they after that they can have begin to be let off the lead and get time off. If with a lateral suture, if you use especially physiotherapy, you can significantly improve the outcome. Okay, so I'd certainly suggest that it would be advisable to most clients that they try and have some physiotherapy or at least some hydrotherapy. And just remember, the suture always fails at 6 to 10 weeks, and it's the periarticular fibrosis that gives long term stability. So then we move on to the tibial osteotomies, okay, which there are a number described. And as I say, I would recommend these in all cases if the owner can afford them and also understands that they are more complex procedures and accepts this sort of complication rate. Although the complication rate these days is relatively low. We have different procedures. There's the cranial closing wedge ostectomy, as shown in this radiograph here. This was first described in the early 80s. It was the sort of first attempt at tibial plateau leveling, and it fell out of favor, if you like. But a lot of that was to do with fixation failures. So there's reports of up to 25% fixation failures. But with the advent of newer plating systems, especially locking plating systems, better implant materials, etc., that this is much less. So the cranial closing wedge ostectomy is very useful. Then there was the tibial plateau leveling osteotomy that was done as a revised tibial plateau leveling to try and get round some of the problems with the cranial closing wedge ostectomy that was seen earlier. A lot of the problems, as I said, were implant related or poorly positioned ostectomies. And a recent study that was done showed no difference in outcome or complications between these two. So really think of those very now very much as being similar. Then we had the tibial tuberosity advancement that was described in the early 2000s. And there's many variations of that. And then finally, there was a triple tibial osteotomy here. So these are really the four mainstays of tibial osteotomies for cranial cruciate ligament disease. And interestingly, there was a study done in the USA recently where a Professor Ross Palmer surveyed referring vets, and it came out that most of the owners, about 75%, wanted an osteotomy for their own dog if they could get cranial cruciate ligament disease. But in actual fact, in the USA, only 8% of dogs are getting osteotomies. 92% of dogs that have cruciate surgery are having some other form of procedure. So as a quick thing, we'll go through these procedures. With TPLO and the CCWO, the aim we want to achieve is a tibial plateau of 5 to 6 degrees. So if we look at this here, we can work out the tibial plateau by drawing a line from the center of the hock up through the intercondylar eminences in the stifle, and then a line across the tibial plateau. Okay, and the tibial plateau angle is this angle in here. Okay, so it's the angle between 90 degrees to the long axis and your tibial plateau. Okay, and that is highly variable, but the aim of these surgeries is to get to a tibial plateau of 5 to 6 degrees. And the hope there is that you decrease the femur sliding down the slope, so femoral caudal subluxation and cranial tibial subluxation. But it's not quite as simple as that because you probably alter how your muscular forces around the joint. So with a TPLO, what we would normally do is we would make a cut on the radius of this circle, so a radial cut along here, and then this proximal fragment will be rotated a certain degree based on the tibial plateau angle you started with and the size of the saw that you used, and then held with a plate and screws, so it would look like this. In a cranial closing wedge, we attempt to level the plateau by taking out a cranially based wedge of bone, so like this triangle of bone here. So this is cut out and then closed, and you end up with it looking like this to level the plateau. And as I said, there's very little difference these days between cranial closing wedge and TPLO. Some people will prefer one over the other, but that's surgeon preference. The outcome and complications are the same. And a lot of the early problems with the wedge osteotomies that meant it kind of fell out of favour in a number of cases have been ironed out. With a tibial tuberosity advancement, the aim of this surgery is to achieve a patella tendon angle of 90 degrees. So the patella tendon angle is an angle between the line of the patella and the line of the tibial plateau. So generally, what you find in the dogs is that this patella tendon angle is over 90 degrees. So what you do with a tibial tuberosity advancement is a cut is made of the tibial tuberosity and it's advanced, it's pulled cranially forward with an idea of achieving this patella tendon angle of 90 degrees. That's the supposed end point of the surgery. However, the validity of this end point has been questioned in the last few years. And it's actually probably got nothing to do with the patella tendon angle of 90 degrees. What you are almost certainly doing is altering the magnitude and the direction of the force of the pull of the quadriceps. So with this surgery in particular, quadriceps, muscle atrophy, pre-op, and then the building up of the muscles afterwards is almost certainly vitally important to the success of it. So this is a procedure that relies on muscle bulk improvement and retraining of the muscles. So again, probably need a good rehabilitation program, especially for dogs that aren't doing quite so well initially. There's many variants of the TTA. As you can see in these radiographs here, we have the TTA2 from Kion, the TTA Rapid, we've got the MMT, and then the MMP. So the idea of these is to try and simplify the procedure, if you like, and make it more available. Now, whether you would do a plateau levelling osteotomy or a TTA, again, is surgeon preference. There's a lot of people that are quite adamant that one is better than the other, and it almost certainly that isn't the case. There was a study recently that questioned the benefit of TTA over a lateral suture, and made them certainly worse than a TPLO. However, there's another study that's ongoing at the moment in Germany that shows TPLO and TTA or MMP have very much the same outcome. So there's differing evidence about these, and these are the studies that have been published are not very good. But certainly there's polarised camps of whether you would say TPLO or TTA. In actual fact, they can be both very successful, and there's still occasions when they don't work. So that's important to note. The idea of the tibial or the triple tibial osteotomy is you're combining a tibial tuberosity advancement with a cranial closing wedge. So you do less of an advancement, less of a wedge. This is not a procedure that's very commonly performed in the UK. Pretty common in Australia, and we're actually the founder of the procedure is based. But it complicates things for no real necessary reason. So we'll talk briefly about the meniscus before we overrun too much. So the menisci are C-shaped discs of fibrocartilage that are within the joint, and they're triangular in cross-section. So they have a thicker peripheral border that's attached to the synovium, and the axial border, like the inside of the joint, is very, very thin. And the menisci serve very important structures. They help convert the joint compressive force to a radial force. So instead of going straight across the joint onto the bone, they spread them out. Okay. And that radial force is resisted by the circumferential collagen fibers in the menisci. So most of the fibers are in this sort of orientation. Not all of them, but most of them. And so that results in this hoop stress, which resists these radial forces. So the load is transferred across the joint without having significant pressure contacts. So menisci, we know we have lateral and medial, and they have this role in the transfer of load, but also in the stability of the joint. The menisci are secondary stabilizers of the stifle. Okay. And the function of them relies on this intact peripheral rim. If you think of the blood supply from comes from the synovium. There's no blood vessels into the menisci, but the blood supply comes from the synovium, but only to the peripheral 15 to 25%. All right. So the vast majority of the menisci is avascular. And then when we think about them, the medial meniscus is more firmly attached to the tibia, and therefore that is why it's more consistently damaged with shear forces. So if you have cranial caudal instability in the knee, the lateral meniscus has more ability to move than the medial meniscus, so the medial meniscus is more likely to be torn. However, that doesn't mean that the lateral meniscus doesn't get torn, and it's something that we always forget. So meniscal injury is common with cruciate ligament disease. We know that. The studies show 33 to 70% incidence at the time they have a cranial cruciate ligament disease. Okay. But then you can get post-operative tears as well. Okay. So they can be latent tears. So those are tears that are missed at the original surgery and progress. Or they can be true post-liminary tears. So post-liminary tears are what they have a normal meniscus at the time of the surgery, the original cruciate surgery, but the tear later on. And the post-operative incidence varies between 3 to 17%, depending on the cruciate ligament surgery that you describe. Now, the diagnosis of meniscal injury can be quite tricky, but often it's a concurrent pathology with the cruciate ligament disease, or you have an acute lameness after the cruciate ligament surgery. True isolated meniscal injuries are extremely rare in dogs. So when we come to diagnose them, the visualization is the best way. But if you're examining your dog, there's two things. You could hear a meniscal click. Okay, so as you put the stifle through flexion extension, you could hear this meniscal click. And if the presence of that is a strong indicator of a meniscal tear. However, just because there isn't a meniscal click, so the absence of a meniscal click is not a strong indicator of a normal meniscus. Okay, so just because you don't have a you there's no meniscal click doesn't mean that the meniscus is normal. The other one that's very useful is pain on flexion. So if you have a dog that's very painful on flexion of the stifle in particular, there's a high chance it will have a meniscal injury. There are a number of things, as we described before. We can have CT arthrograms, MRI, or ultrasound to diagnose a meniscal injury. Now, most of the time, I would not do that. Okay, and most of the time, we go to visualization, arthrotomy, or arthroscopy because we have a high index of suspicion of a meniscal injury, and that allows us to treat it at the same time without spending a lot of money on very expensive investigations. Ultrasound obviously isn't as expensive as CT or MRI, but it's hugely operator dependent. You would need an extremely able ultrasonographer to pick up meniscal injury. So what's the treatment for meniscal injury? Surgical debridement through an arthrotomy or an arthroscopy. You could do a partial meniscectomy or a hemimeniscectomy, where you actually remove the entire, medial or lateral meniscus. Okay, but you need to preserve as much of the functional meniscus as possible. So by that, we mean the outer peripheral ring and the intact meniscal ligaments. Okay, if you cut the outer peripheral ring or you cut the meniscal ligaments, that meniscus function is almost zero. Okay, so you've lost a huge amount of its function. In humans, they talk about meniscal repair, specifically of peripheral tears where there's a vascular supply, or meniscal grafting. And again, it has been spoken about and talked about in dogs, but these are very difficult to do, especially in our patient size. Couple of things that are very useful for meniscal surgeries is for visualization. So you can use a seine retractor for the fat pad. You can cut the fat pad out, but getting stifle distractors in to really distract the joint and open it up makes a big difference. So we would place these, and you'd place one end on the intercondylar notch in the femur, so kind of where the cruciate ligaments are, and then another on the non-articular tibial plateau, so just cranial to the meniscus, and you can really crank the joint open, which will massively increase your visualization. Then we'd use Gilpies to retract the joint capsule, sort of medial lateral. And that normally is enough to be able to see in there. But when you're in, there's a few things. You need to inspect the medial and lateral meniscus, and it can be quite difficult to visualize them, especially the caudal poles, which is normally where more of the significant tears are. So one useful thing is to probe the meniscus. Okay, and the intact meniscus is pretty tough, so if you're probing it, don't worry about that. But you'll be able to therefore see, is there more movement, is there a tear that you can't actually see? And then you would remove the damaged meniscus. Okay, but it can be difficult. So what is often useful is little Halstead mosquito forceps that have a crocodile tip on them, and it will give you better grasping, and then use a very small blade to take them out. Now, arthroscopy increases your ability to visualize the meniscus. Okay, but obviously it's not that widely available. It increases the cost. But there's another thing, that if you cannot see a meniscal injury with your own eyes or by probing it, I would question whether it was actually significant. Okay. There's a lot of accepted wisdom that you must treat meniscal surgery. It's kind of eminence-based medicine. It's ingrained into people for decades. All right. However, there are almost certainly a lot of meniscal injuries that don't need treatment. Okay. Now, what we don't know is exactly which ones do and which ones don't. There's a lot of work to go on to this. But if in doubt, I would always leave the meniscus alone. The meniscus is really important. So if you think you've got a very small tear, I would leave that alone. I wouldn't touch it. Okay. Nobody has yet been able to explain to me, if you've got a small tear and you cut it out, why is your iatrogenic tear that you've just created any better? Okay. So places that I don't want to touch when I look at the meniscus is the outer rim, because of the hoop stress. If you cut the outer rim, the function of the meniscus is gone. So you want to leave the outer rim at all possible. And that's also where you have the synovial attachments, so the blood supply to that area. I find in my cases that if I have a dog that has a significant problem and it's not responded to conservative management, that the most significant tear is where you have a large bucket handle tear, or in the caudal horn, or the complete caudal horn, so it's folding forward, okay, and it's actually folding over on itself and getting caught under the femur. Those certainly cause significant lameness. And finally, we're talking about cruciate surgery. We can't ignore the caudal cruciate ligament. So isolated caudal cruciate ligament ruptures are very rare. Normally, we'd see them in combination with cranial cruciate ligament ruptures, collateral ligament ruptures, or meniscal injury. So these are often dogs that have sort of the stifle derangement, stifle luxation, because they've had significant trauma. Okay. If we do see an isolated caudal cruciate ligament rupture, which isn't impossible, we've got two options: conservative management or surgery. And normally with these, it's often I will leave these and just treat them conservatively. So pain relief, controlled exercise, physiotherapy, hydrotherapy, and especially in our smaller animals. We still need to investigate it and just take the radiographs. And sometimes you'll actually see an avulsion fracture. So the origin of the caudal cruciate has avulsed off the femur. And if that's a large enough fragment, you could go in and internally, reduce that and stabilize it with a very small screw or K wires or something like that. That can be done in large dogs, and if that's possible, then that would be a good thing to do. If you have a ligament tear, so mid-substance, and it's not responding to conservative management, then we can do the extracapsular techniques or intra-articular grafts, a bit like for the caudal cruciate, for the cranial cruciate, but we do it in the opposite way. So the likes of the extracapsular technique, instead of going from the lateral fibula, you go from the sort of proximal and patella ligament at the patella down to the medial tibia or the fibula, if you like, whether you're going medially or laterally, okay, or you would just try to replace it internally. So for caudal cruciate ligament, just remember, tears do happen. Most of the time, they're involved in stifle derangement, stifle luxation, but not always. They do get isolated tears. Conservative management almost certainly is enough. If you go for surgery, in these cases, I would have generally done extra capsular techniques. So slightly over, but that's it for today.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Scott for an excellent presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.